Do you invest in ETFs? Whether you're thinking, what in the world is an ETF? Or you're looking for the next opportunity to add to your portfolio. GlobalX has you covered. From big tech to bonds and bars of gold, GlobalX offers a wide range of exchange-traded funds. Go beyond ordinary with GlobalX ETFs. Visit globalxetfs.com.au. That's globalxetfs.com.au.
InvestSmart's portfolios are turning 10. And to celebrate, 10 InvestSmart boot camps are up for grabs. This self-paced online course is ideal for both seasoned investors and those who are just starting out. Valued at $99, you could win a spot on this highly rated course. To enter the competition and for terms and conditions, simply visit investsmart.com.au/win. Don't miss out on this chance to learn from experts and take your investing to the next level. Simply visit investsmart.com.au/win. Good luck.
Hey there, here's a quick note. This podcast contains general financial advice only. That means it's not specific to you, your needs, goals, or objectives, so don't act on the information until you've spoken with your financial advisor. You'll find our full disclosure, disclaimer, and link to our financial services guide in the show notes.
Stephanie, thank you for taking some time to join me on the show.
Thank you for having me.
It's great to be able to speak with someone like yourself in any case, but when you're in Australia and you're touring around, it's wonderful to have this time because I know it's a busy schedule. I've got a few questions for you. My partner in crime here on the podcast, his name's Drew, and he thought that your book was probably the most enlightening economic book he's ever read. And I can assure you he has studied and read a few in his time, but he absolutely loved it. And it's just a shame he can't be here to do this with me. But I've got a question for you, given this is an investing focused podcast. Is writing a book a good investment?
Well, it's a huge investment of time, I can tell you that much. I didn't want to write this book, which is the kind of crazy thing. I talked with a friend of mine, and she had written 7 New York Times bestsellers. And I was kind of kicking around the idea of writing a book. And she said to me, well, darling, you must be pregnant with a book. And I thought, what in the world is she talking about? And then I came to realize that what she meant was, you don't write a book because you want to, you write a book because you have to. It's almost as if there's something living inside of you that you need to get out of you. And I think that's what she meant by being pregnant with a book. And that's how I felt about The Deficit Myth. So, you know, it turned out to be actually a New York Times bestseller. So in that sense, it was a good quote unquote investment, I suppose. But mostly I just think of it as a grind, you know, as something I had to grind out. It was a huge investment of my time, but I did it because I felt like nobody had yet kind of put the ideas out there in a way that was really accessible to the lay reader, that wasn't, you know, heavy with jargon and felt kind of inaccessible for folks. And I wanted to try to fill what I thought was maybe a hole there, a need. And so that's what I tried to do.
And obviously it did, because like you said, it was such a success and it is such a success and it's a wonderful read. So, from where I sit, from the outside at least, it looks like a great investment. Not all investments have to, shower us in cash and all these types of things. Sometimes, like you said, it can be just the pursuit of something intellectual that is a wonderful investment and has a return beyond what you thought. And I did hear a story of an interview you did you may have been in the UK or Europe somewhere recently. It was on YouTube. I saw an interview with you, and you said the book led to, I think it was I could be mistaken here, Stephanie, I think it was a senator from Kentucky who read the book, who was typically more conservative in nature, and sent you a message and basically said that it helped open my eyes and allow me to kind of, you know, I guess reinforce policies and I guess vote on things that mattered in a way that he never thought was possible. And so I think those are the types of things, like when you say pregnant and something that you had to get out, I feel like those are the types of things we don't often think about, those profound kind of consequences that have a ripple effect. But my second kind of icebreaker question for you was for folks who aren't necessarily familiar, maybe not with the book or maybe with you, is to imagine a Super Bowl ad. This is kind of, you know, timely, I guess. Imagine a Super Bowl ad with your name on it, and it gives us a highlight reel. And I know this isn't going to do us justice, but for folks who don't know, can you maybe just relive some of the really impactful times in your career thus far that gives you people a sense of what you work on and where you spend most of your time and energy?
Yeah, I mean, I spent 17 years. It's almost hard to believe I can say those words, but I taught at the University of Missouri in Kansas City for 17 years. And before that, I sort of stumbled into economics. I didn't grow up saying as a little kid, when I grow up, I want to be an economist. So that was not, you know, on the bingo card, but it was sort of just a series of accidents. You know, you have a professor, you take an econ class, you sort of like the professor, maybe not necessarily the material, but you keep going. And then at some point you develop a real affinity for the, you know, the study of economics. And for me, that was the history of economic thought course. And then I paired it with a finance degree. So I got dual degrees and went off to Cambridge University. And the, you know, story just sort of goes from there. But I end up with my first teaching job at the University of Missouri in Kansas City. And I was there for a lot of years, and really fortunate to have been working alongside people like Randy Ray and Matt Forstatter. Pavlina Chernova was a graduate student, but now, you know, is chair of the economics department at Bard College. And so we had this cohort of MMT-oriented economists, and we were able to collaborate with one another and really build out this project for a long period of time. And then one day, kind of out of the blue, I got a phone call from the staff director on the U.S. Senate Budget Committee. And he was calling on behalf of Senator Bernie Sanders. And the Democrats had just lost the Senate. And Senator Sanders was going to be the incoming ranking member of the Senate Budget Committee. And he had never held that position before. And the budget committee has a chief economist to serve Democrats and a chief economist to serve Republicans. And they were looking for someone to be the chief economist for the Democrats. And so I got this call, and Senator Sanders got on the phone, and we had a conversation, and he asked me a series of questions, and we hung up. And 2 days later, he called back, asked me the same questions. I answered them. And at the end of the call, he said, you know, what do you think? You want to come do this job? And it was 2 weeks before Christmas. And I had kids that were pretty young at the time. And the next thing I knew, 2 weeks later, I had a job in Washington, D.C., in an apartment. And I was on leave from my position at the university. And I did that for about a year and a half or so. And then, you know, advised the presidential campaign and eventually returned to Kansas City, taught just a little bit longer. And then my husband and I moved to New York, and I'm at Stony Brook University now for 8 years or so there. So in and out, I've been able to, you know, see things from outside the so-called ivory tower, and just been really fortunate to have the experience of, you know, getting to work in Congress and to learn up close, you know, what actually takes place, for better or worse.
There's so much that we could learn from just sitting and hearing you talk. And I know I have in doing preparation for this conversation. We had Professor Bill Mitchell on the show recently. He was I was fortunate enough to speak with him here in Melbourne. And he introduced us. We've spoken about it before many times on the show, but he introduced us from kind of the, well, I guess, academic perspective, and then also in practice, what it means to think like someone who is conscious of MMT, modern monetary theory, its application, the high level kind of policy framework, if you like. But for folks who haven't had that introduction, and I don't want to spend too much time on this because a lot of them would have heard it, but how do you explain this, I guess? How do you explain MMT to someone that may be new to you and new to these kind of economic concepts?
Well, in the book, I start, you know, the first chapter of the book is called Don't Think of a Household. So I really think that's the the starting point, right? Everything falls apart once you begin to theorize or use metaphors that liken the government's ability to spend to that of a household or an individual business. You know, once you start talking about living within your means and balancing the books and maxing out the credit card and all of those metaphors that we, you know, hear politicians and journalists and so forth talk about. So, you know, I think MMT starts with that recognition that we're really focused on public currency, the public money, the public currency, if you like, and the monetary system that we have today, the mechanics of government finance. How does it all work in the modern era where you have a floating exchange rate, fiat currency, governments that issue the currency don't pledge to convert it into something they could run out of, like gold or another country's currency? So how should we think about the process of budgeting in a world in which the government has effectively, you know, a blank checkbook? If Congress wants to write legislation and the votes are there to authorize the spending of trillions of dollars on COVID, infrastructure, climate-related spending, semiconductors, we've watched them do it, right? And this is what, it kind of goes back to the point you raised a bit ago about the congressman from Kentucky, whose name is John Yarmuth. And you're quite right that John Yarmuth considered himself, for all the years that he was in Congress before encountering these ideas, he said, look, I'm a deficit hawk. I'm a sound finance guy. I want balanced budgets, and I think deficits are irresponsible. And this is the way that he kind of operated during his time in Congress, until he had a change in his way of thinking. And once he was able to reframe, right, and to understand the government is not like a household, not like a private business, not like state and local governments, that they have the power of the purse, and that the thing to watch out for, the limit, is inflation. It's not insolvency, you're not going to bankrupt the country and all that sort of stuff. So he understood then that you can operate your budget more aggressively in response to something like the COVID pandemic, but that you do have to be mindful of inflation. And that's really at the core of the MMT project.
I'm actually going to bring in something that's a little bit more recent for people. And I'm glad you spoke, just touched on their COVID. Because I think a lot of people began to immerse themselves in these concepts around the GFC, the Great Financial Crisis. Because of things like QE, people were exploring what those two letters meant when they were put side by side and capitalized, right? But then in COVID, we saw a distinct challenge that maybe many people in the world and leaders hadn't dealt with, and indeed most of them hadn't dealt with at that scale. And we saw a lot of stimulus come into the system, and some people, maybe critics, and this is to the point around inflation, have maybe able to say, since then, well, inflation did go up. Maybe that's because of stimulus. And I've heard you answer this question before, and I think it's very eloquent when you do, but how do you kind of pull that argument apart? Like, how do you think about, well, does it cause inflation? You know, was COVID an example of that? Was there something else at work?
Well, okay, so let's pick it apart, because you started with QE, right? And I think pretty clearly QE cannot be blamed for inflation, right? I mean, we in the U.S. Ran QE for the better part of a decade after the GFC, which you also mentioned. So Bernanke starts this up. And at the time, this is seen as, you know, the central bank stomping on the accelerator. Okay, we're going to rev up the car and we're going to get out of the ditch. And QE is going to be a big part of how we pull the economy out of the doldrums. And the MMT economist said, I don't know what you all are smoking, but QE, the way we view it, you know, QE is an asset swap. I don't know what magic you think happens thereafter, but you're taking mortgage-backed securities and treasuries onto your balance sheet, you being the central bank, and you're replacing them with reserve balances earning zero, right, at the time. And somehow you think that this is going to reflate the economy. And of course, Japan had been trying this already for at least a decade, and no success, no sign of inflation rising to the 2% target. So here we are saying, well, Japan's been doing it for a decade. I guess we'll try it and somehow expect a different result. And so we weren't fans of QE back when Bernanke did it. Not only weren't we fans, we were critics. We wrote a lot about QE and how we thought people were getting it wrong in terms of thinking about it as a form of stimulus. But then you said, well, we spent a lot of money during COVID. So there were large fiscal packages. And this is true. You know, the first one came in March of 2020. So really, just as COVID was bearing down on the U.S. and the world, really. And Congress responded. We had Donald Trump as president, Democrats in control of the House, Republicans in control of the Senate. So this is bipartisan legislation. But, you know, they kicked out a $2.2 trillion package. And it sounded like a lot of money at the time. And it is a lot of money. But there was no hesitation. They did this very quickly. And then they followed in December of the same year with $900 billion additional. And then the Democrats came back in March of 2021 in control of the House, the Senate, and the White House. And we got a $1.9 trillion package. So if you add those three together, that's $5 trillion in the span of 12 months that was committed through Congress. So I'd say a couple of things. First, a really good example of what MMT was saying all along, which is you don't find the money, you find the votes. And if the votes are there, the money is there. And this demonstrated that pretty clearly. There was no effort to, quote unquote, pay for this. Nobody went to China and said, may we please borrow some dollars? There was no tax increase to offset the spending or any of that. It was just, you know, increasing the deficit. Now, we did get inflation alongside some of that spending, really starting around April of 2021. So very soon after the Democrat-only package. And then the question becomes, well, where did the inflation come from, right? How much of the blame for the rising inflation can we ascribe to doing too much on the fiscal side? How much is down to pandemic-related shifts in the way people were spending, less spending on services, more on goods, bottlenecks, supply chain, all of that stuff that we all know about? Later, Ukraine, food, energy. So, you know, a lot of people, the Federal Reserve banks, Moody's Analytics, everybody is trying to sort of do an autopsy, right? And say, can we dissect the CPI or the PCE and say how much of the added inflationary pressure came from this thing or that thing or the other thing? So these debates are obviously likely to continue for years to come. I think some of it, surely, you can say some of it was related to the very robust fiscal packages. But I think the vast majority of the research that's been done so far points to the pandemic doing most of the damage when it came to, you know, pushing inflation higher. And I'll just say one last thing and then I'll stop, which is, inflation has drifted down, right, globally. And so people are saying, well, the Fed raised interest rates, the ECB raised interest rates, Bank of England raised interest rates, central banks had to fight inflation. They got interest rates up, inflation came down. Therefore, we have evidence that monetary policy has successfully curbed inflationary pressures and it's getting inflation back down. Only I would say, well, hang on, let's talk about Japan, because inflation finally appeared in Japan after being, you know, dormant for the better part of three decades. Japan actually finally got inflation well above their 2% target. Only the Bank of Japan didn't respond by hiking rates. They left the policy rate negative through the entirety of COVID. And here we are. And inflation has come crashing down in Japan just like it has everywhere else. So I think there's a really interesting conversation and debate to be had about whether the rate hikes were even necessary to get to where we are today.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And I keep on coming back to the Japan case study again and again, but I think I may have read or heard that amongst those research houses and institutions that have done kind of that autopsy, as you speak of, I think the what many of them have basically put to the fiscal packages is basically, you know, very, very small is what they've ascribed to that. And we're talking like less than 0.5%. And I think if it, the more people sit back and remember, you know, 3 or 4 years ago, we were saying, how can we get inflation? Where is it going to come from? Interest rates in Australia were historic lows. And even here, we couldn't get any readings to show any kind of life support on the inflation reading. I've got a question, which this is a bit off script, but it was kind of something that I'm just hoping I can get your feedback on. And that a lot of what we think about when we think about central banks is an inflation target, right? In terms of how we think about what a central bank's purpose is and what it should be doing, I don't know if it was you that made this remark or some other research that I came across recently where maybe that's the wrong target entirely. Maybe the target is employment. And I think this is something that you've spoken about many times before. But in effect, you know, if I think about what would mean that economy thrives and society thrives, I would think that employment as a target is a more pure way to look at how we can make that society thrive rather than, say, inflation, which seems arbitrary to most people. I don't know if that's just a waffly question or not, Stephanie, but I think about that quite a bit. And I think about, you know, people's purpose, households, businesses, and that type of a thing, reflecting on the experience during COVID in particular, where a very different kind of return to normal, quote unquote, was seen versus the GFC. It was much faster. There was more people back at work sooner, particularly in the United States. I don't know if that's a question or not, but it's just something that I think a lot about. And I'm just curious if how you think about that.
Well, I think inflation is, people don't like it. And so it's clearly a problem. And it is obviously a hardship for many people when prices are increasing. But, you know, people have been facing rising costs, and it's been harmful for a very long time. Only it's been healthcare, it's been education, it's transportation to some extent. I mean, you know, people are dealing with rising costs, economic insecurity, those levels for roughly half of the U.S. population anyway, hasn't had more than $400 in savings. It turns out that tight labor markets are a solution to a great many things that are ailments in our economy. So we've managed just in recent years to begin to reverse decades-long patterns of rising wage inequality just because of the fact that the labor market has been so tight. It's been easier for workers to switch jobs, to move into better jobs, to negotiate better pay. So I think you're right, and you're onto something clearly when you say, you know, the health of the labor market is really critical. I would just add that, you know, maintaining some degree of price stability is also really critical. Maybe most importantly, politically, because inflation really is a political problem, not just an economic problem for those who, you know, struggle to keep pace in terms of, you know, nominal wages and so forth. So I guess from where I sit, one of the good pieces of news to come out of all of this is that with each passing day, it seems more and more people are willing to throw the Phillips curve onto the trash heap of, you know, neoclassical models and theories that are falling out of favor, because, you know, it's pretty obvious to everyone at this point that you can, there isn't this inherent trade-off, that we can have inflation come down from around 9% to close to 3% or less without any material increase in unemployment. And so I think you're right. We want both low inflation and low unemployment. And for a very long time, we thought we had to choose between the two. And I think more and more we're beginning to realize that it is in fact possible to achieve both.
Yeah, I think you referenced previously a study, and I think it may have been done out of New Zealand. They basically showed people's happiness and through time, and they effectively how they felt about the economy and what have you. And it didn't seem to have any relationship with inflation. It was more related to employment and security around those types of things, which to me seems very, maybe it's overly simplistic, but it seems like a pure way to think about what we should actually be angling towards, as well as you say, within the bumper bars of inflation and these types of things. So I guess one of the questions that I have then is, I don't know if it was on your Australian roadshow or something that you did, but I think it may have been on X or Twitter, people thinking about MMT rather than like a policy description, but more as like a lens. Can you just describe what you meant by that?
Yeah, I mean, MMT is an analytical framework. So when, the title of my Substack is The Lens, and that's designed to really focus people on the idea that what we're trying to do is give people a clearer picture. You know, you go to your optometrist because you want 20/20 vision, right? And if you can't see clearly, you go to the eye doc and you say, help me improve my eyesight, right? I need to see better. And the optometrist will take you through a series of questions and fit you with glasses or contact lenses or whatever. And you'll walk out and you'll be able to see the world more clearly. The optometrist doesn't tell you where to go when you get in your car. Doesn't say, drive here, or you're going to the grocery store, buy these groceries and make this for dinner. That doesn't come with a set of instructions about exactly what to do, but they've given you a clearer picture. And I think that's ultimately the hope with MMT, is that we're trying to provide a framework through which you get a better understanding, a better picture of what the limits are, what policy options are available to you. And then at that point, it becomes a matter of policy, right? And then lawmakers can at least have a more fruitful debate instead of debating things like finding the money and the impact on the budget and the number that pops out of the budget box at the end of every year and all of that sort of stuff. We're trying to say, no, that's not the focus of public policy. It shouldn't be the goal to achieve any particular budget outcome at the end of the fiscal year or whatever. The goal is to achieve a good economy, right? Define that. What are the objectives? High levels of employment, low levels of inflation, low rates of poverty, high rates of literacy, and all the rest, right? What does a good economy look like? What are the policy goals? And then pursue those goals, mindful that there are real resource constraints, that there is a limit, that you can't, just because you have the power of the purse doesn't mean that you can, fund everything and attempt to carry out every objective all at once in full force. You've got to manage resources. You've got to be mindful of inflation risk. And, but you don't have to budget like a household, but you do have to budget judiciously with inflation at the heart of the project. And that's what we're trying to do.
Probably got time for one more question. But I will make a call out for anyone that wants a copy of The Deficit Myth. You can head online. There is a link in your show notes of this. But also anyone who asks a question about MMT during the month of April on the show, we will send you a copy of Stephanie's book. Stephanie, I know you do so much, including video, including podcasts. Other than the book, is there anywhere else where you would send our community who are very much interested in MMT and everything that you would produce?
Oh, sure. I mean, there's so much. This is like beyond our, I think, wildest imagination as academics. It's not, I think, very often that a group of academic economists is producing scholarship, and suddenly there's a movement, globally, with people getting excited about the work, people who are starting their own podcasts and their own blogs and their own YouTube channels and all the rest of it. So you do have to be a bit careful about where you turn, right? Yeah. I would encourage people to probably try to stick pretty closely to the academic and scholarly literature. But there are so many books out there. You mentioned that you've had Bill Mitchell on the program before. He writes a blog and he posts very regularly. That's obviously a very good resource. Randy Ray, I mentioned earlier, has a number of books. And I think the most recent one is a cartoon book, which is his attempt to make MMT very digestible, you know, to lay readers. But he's got a number of books. Pavlina has a book on full employment. So there's lots out there. There are blogs and podcasts. But I would probably encourage people to try to stick to the, you know, scholarly contributions from
as close to the source as possible.
Yeah, as much as possible.
Yeah. My final question is, actually, I might be able to sneak in two quick ones, but this one was just a quick one I wanted to nip in the bud, which is the role that basically our politicians have to play in taxation, if you think about them overseeing that system. In Australia, you mentioned some of the issues that can come from inflation, things like food and things like energy and these types of things. But one of the problems that we have in Australia as it relates to supply undoubtedly is housing. People cannot find rent. People cannot find homes to buy or live in. And I think that illustrates a very important point about MMT as its application may result here in Australia, is we have demand, but we don't have supply. And understanding how interest rate settings may impact that is very important. So I guess the kind of quick question is, do you think that across a country like Australia or the United States, because they're very similar in this regard, do you think that we have the people infrastructure and the political infrastructure to implement more MMT-like policies in the near future?
Well, again, MMT-like policies makes me But if you're saying, do we have the capacity to invest in housing, to address a housing crisis, which you have here and we absolutely have in the U.S.? And, you know, you're right that central banks' interest rate policy is contributing to some of the problems in the housing markets, making housing more affordable for more people. We are short, depending on the estimate, somewhere between 2 and 6 million housing units in the U.S. We need to massively build housing for people. And I know that you have the same similar kinds of problems here. You know, for us, a big part of the problem is really at the local level. It has to do with zoning and those sort of permitting. And that's a different problem. That's not a money and a financing problem. That's a local legal and regulatory, right? That sort of problem. I imagine some of that is also true here. I don't know the Australian situation well, but if you've got, you know, land upon which you can build, and if, let's just say, you want to do a huge public housing project, and you've got the contractors and the engineers and the architects and the lumber and the concrete and the machines and all the things, you know, that you need to construct housing, then the money is the easy part. It's the mobilization of the real resources that you need and a plan to, you know, make those investments over a period of time in ways that allow you to do it without, you know, exacerbating inflationary pressures along the way.
My final question is just a question that I ask everyone on the show, which is, it does often prompt people to think quite deeply, but simple answers are fine, Stephanie. Is if you could go back and tell your younger self one thing about finance, investing, business, or life, what would it be?
So it's tough because I already sort of followed what I think is probably the best advice that I would give, which is to just do what you want to do and don't be afraid. And, you know, I understood at a pretty early age that I was going to suffer the slings and arrows of a whole lot of folks for coloring outside the lines, right? For stepping outside the mainstream, for being a critic of mainstream macro, that does get you disinvited from lots of the fun parties, but that's okay. That was okay for me because I didn't that wasn't my aspiration, was not to climb a political ladder or any of those sorts of things. And yet I got invited into some of those rooms, and I got to play a role in helping to shape, you know, policy for the incoming Biden administration. I got to be part of a presidential run, and in that capacity, I feel like it has served me well to not have conformed in ways that I might have been encouraged to by some of my peers at an early stage. And so I guess I would tell others, be fearless.
Yeah, great answer. Stephanie, thank you for taking some time to join me on the show today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks for listening to this podcast. Before you go, I wanted to share some things with you. Specifically, I wanted to tell you about the 10 ways that Rask could help you in 2024. As many of you know, Rask has grown to become one of the biggest investing and finance platforms in Australia. Across our podcasts, our websites, our memberships, and so on, we now engage around 200,000 Aussies, which, considering we started in a humble lounge room on a Kmart desk, one of those old fake white wooden ones, I'm pretty ecstatic about where we are 6 years later. As part of becoming one of Australia's biggest platforms for wealth creation and preservation, we now have a very special position in the country in that we can bring you some of the best, most thoughtful, expert-driven ways to protect and grow your wealth. And I'm going to share some of those with you now. I've got 10 ways that we can potentially help you or match you with someone who can. The first thing that I want to tell you about is the biggest step we've ever taken at Rask, which is the launch of our Rask Invest platform. This is a platform that lets our team, led by me, invest for you, primarily through low-cost, diversified ETFs. We'll have three strategies at launch, and every investor who comes through can pick one of the three strategies, being a balanced strategy, a growth strategy, and a high growth strategy. The balanced strategy focuses on passive income, and the high growth strategy focuses on longer term compounding. You will find a link in your podcast player to register your interest. We will be taking off soon. Number two, if you prefer to DIY your investing, you can join me and over 4,000 members inside Rask Core. That's our full ETF and ASX share research membership community. You can join now and you'll get updated ETF portfolio recommendations every quarter, as well as ongoing ASX and global stock research. Every single month, we call them the All-Star Stocks. You get that alongside the ETF portfolios, as well as other members-only content. It's called Rask Core. Number three, our first ever partnership with a business other than our own was a business by the name of Blusk, which has since become Flint Group. Flint Group is led by Chris Bates and Christian Stevens, two of Australia's most highly regarded mortgage brokers. Already over 200 Rask community members have begun the Rask plus Flint Group mortgage broking process. You can click the link in your podcast player if you're refinancing, investing, a first home buyer, or whatever. You've probably heard Chris on the show many times. Number four, you can connect with our most trusted financial advisors. Whether you're 25 years old, just graduated uni and looking to set yourself up, or approaching or in retirement and you've got that nest egg you want to protect and generate a passive income from, you can get in contact with our trusted panel of financial advisors. You can find the link in your podcast player. It's there each and every week. Just click the thing that says financial planning. Number five, if you want specialist insurance advice, as Warren Buffett said, rule number one is don't lose money. And rule number two is don't forget rule number one. Insurance is vitally important, especially when it comes to your number one asset, you. Whether you're a single income household or a couple, and you just want to protect what would happen if, you want to protect your family if something goes wrong, you want to protect your spouse if you lose your job, you want to protect yourself if you hurt yourself on the weekend at footy, insurance is a way to do that. And I think the best way to do insurance is through a financial planner. And there's a few reasons for that, but one of them is sometimes some insurers will only work with financial advisors, but they can also be your companion as you go through the sometimes daunting process of getting insurance done properly. Sometimes you might not even know, but you're not even covered, even though you think you are. So get the right advice. You'll find a link in the show notes to check that out. Number six, buying property. If you're like me and you're thinking of buying property in the next 12 months, or maybe you've already invested and you're looking to downsize, getting the right advice and being able to build wealth through property is a proven strategy. It might be one of the most contentious, but I think that we have one of Australia's best property coaches in our ranks. That is Pete Wargent. Pete is the host of the now super popular Australian property podcast by Rask, and he's also my analyst team's macro consultant. So if you're a member of Rask Core, you will have seen Pete's name around the traps. He's a property coach and buyer's agent, and he works with a select number of people each and every year. Just a note on this. This is not a commercial thing with Pete. Pete just has great services, so we offer them to the community. And when he fills up, he fills up. You can find out more about Pete's coaching in the show notes. Next up, tracking your portfolio for tax? I think you are, because I think you have to. So we've partnered with Nevexa to help you manage your share and ETF reporting, whether it's tax or performance. All RASC users get 20% off an annual plan with Nevexa. You can sync your portfolio with Nevexa's software, and it automatically tracks your dividends, your capital gains tax, and more. Again, not a commercial partnership. We don't make anything from working with Nevexa, but they do create some great tools which the RASC community uses each and every day. Number eight, want to run your own business? Maybe you already do. If you want more profit, but less stress, less time consumed, and less energy lost, get in contact. We have a partner business called Inflection. The Inflection Accelerator Program is a complete online course that helps you and a community of members engage and follow a proven strategy for growing your business. I'm grateful to be one of the coaches inside the Accelerator program, helping business owners right across Australia. You can find more following the link in your podcast player. It's the one that says coaching. Number nine, if you haven't already checked it out, join over 20,000 other people who tune into the RASC YouTube channel. It is completely free and you get notified when we go live and when we publish podcast episodes. There is a podcast on the RASC network each and every day, as well as bite-sized material that's less than 60 seconds, or those really punchy tutorials and webinars that are just 15 minutes that take you through a really exciting topic, whether it's how to buy a property, whether it's how to pick a dividend ETF. Some of our most popular content actually just explains things like, what the heck is franking credits and how do I calculate if I've got some? That's on our YouTube channel. Number 10, if you want to be a better investor, a saver, a better partner with money, or just understand your own relationship with money, you can do that. All of that by going to the RASC Education website and taking a free course. We've enrolled over 26,000 students at the time of this recording, and we are on a mission to get to 100,000 in the next few years. RASC Education is our mostly free education platform, covering everything from budgeting and automation to the probably, I would say, the best value investing program in the country. So whether you're a value investor, an intermediate investor, you want to know how to value Woolworths shares, or you simply just want to understand what ethical investing is, or buy your first property and what actually happens on settlement day, head to the RASC Education website and enroll in something today. It is free and it supports us, because then I can come on here next month and I can say we've got 27,000, and hopefully we reach critical mass where we can help more Australians manage their money better. Thank you for listening to this long-winded ad. If you want to get in contact with me, you know where to go. There's a link in your show notes. Basically, these 10 services, even though some of them we don't make any money from, support RASC and allow us to produce these podcasts, attract the biggest and best guests from Australia and around the world, and bring them to you to answer your questions. Thank you for being part of the RASC network, and thank you for your ongoing support. Bye for now.